not that it's very possible to ignore, but that Robert Davi line that as he's walking off the stage and says, must be weird to be in a job that where people don't come on you, is one of the craziest things I've ever heard in a movie.
I know, with the movie, yeah, with the music underneath it. And
welcome to Sincast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Sincast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by Barrett Sher from CinemaSins.
Hello.
And today we're going to be interviewing Jeffrey McHale, who has directed, produced, edited a documentary about Showgirls and other Verhoeven movies called You Don't Know Me, as in N-O-M-I, Know Me Malone. First question I have to ask you is, do you like Showgirls?
Oh, I love me?
Yes.
Yes, of course. I love Showgirls. Mm-hmm. It's a film like nothing else. It's one of those crazy artifacts in our cinema history that I don't think you could recreate. I think it's one of those unique things that it's special. It's been celebrated for the last 25 years. Is it, a good film? I think that is clearly, still up for debate, but I think it's an entertaining film. I think it's spoken and it resonates with, large groups of people, and, we're still talking about it now. So, it had to have done something right.
Yeah, I know it sounds kind of like a weird question since you just made a documentary about it and everything, of course. But I feel like sometimes maybe you didn't go into this thinking that it was a good movie or fun movie or whatever, and then came out of it with a different opinion. And one of the things about this movie that I really liked about You Don't Know Me is I've never looked at Showgirls in the way that some of these people have looked at it before.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was something. Now that I watch it, I'm looking for stuff. How much of this was apparent to you when you first watched Showgirls?
I mean, a lot of the kind of the deep dive analysis that I found in the writing about Showgirls. I mean, that kind of all glossed over me for the first few years. After watching it, I just kind of appreciated for its kind of badness in the way that how entertaining it was. And so I think it was just more the experience of it and the absurdity of it and the vulgarness of it and everything that kind of kept me returning to it. And I think it was after I was actually at the way, this kind of started, I was actually at the 20th anniversary screening of Showgirls that's featured at the end of You Don't Know Me, where Elizabeth Berkley presents the film. I was one of those 4,000 people in the audience.
Oh, really?
Wow. Screening that night. And so that was just such a, it was a mind blowing thing. Cause we have these outdoor film screenings in LA, and, I usually try to go to them, a couple times a summer, and occasionally you'll have someone associated with the film show up and, introduce a film or answer some questions afterwards. But with this, I mean, none of us, in our group ever even imagined that anybody would be there attending. It just didn't even occur. So when she walked out, it just was like, I like to say that it was like the closest thing I had to a religious experience. Everyone just immediately leapt to their feet, and just this wave of gasps and emotion just kind of like went through the crowd, and it was beautiful. It was just crazy to know that, we were then going to experience Showgirls with, Nomi Malone herself.
Yeah, this is a great moment in the documentary, because one of the things that I think a lot of people forget when they express their opinions about movies and they go really hard at something is the, you know, and this sounds corny, but the human beings behind it and everything. Mm-hmm. Nobody went into Showgirls hoping that, you know, they were going to be famous for these reasons. Mm-hmm. And there's so much, you know, there's so you have this long line of footage of people basically treating Elizabeth Berkley like shit. And then by the end of it, she's got that moment where 4,000 people are cheering her for this.
Yeah.
This
movie. And she makes that little gesture and everything and everybody goes wild.
Oh, yeah. Gosh.
Yeah. It was, you know, I don't think it's necessarily a spoiler because, you know, it happened 5 years ago and people have discussed it. But yeah, it's a beautiful way to kind of wrap up the conversation that we just had. And I definitely wanted to start the film kind of analyzing it and looking at the critiques and how brutal they were. And, you know, we start the film with, you know, this kind of nasty, you know, montage of, you know, everything that had been written about it. You know, there's a terrible quote from Gene Siskel where he, you know, just critiques her looks and just kind of degrades her appearance and that, you know, just stings to this day. And so, you know, it was a joke. I mean, people just made fun of it for years and years and years, but, you know, it did not take long for the, you know, the queer community, the cult following to find it. And, you know, they were already embracing it at midnight screenings, you know, at that point, you know, it was about a year afterwards. So it didn't take long for, you know, it to find its audience, but, you know, it definitely took about 20 years for, kind of the critical world and, you know, the, film, you know, film elites and scholars kind of revisit it and, you know, now talk about it differently.
There's such a rewatchability to Verhoeven's films that I think leads to this, like naturally leads to this analysis. When I think about when Starship Troopers came out, it was marketed as just a slam bang action thriller, rah rah military type of thing, and a lot of people watched it like that, like my 17-year-old self, and it took, in from what my experience was, it took years for people to realize the satire that was endemic to it. Same thing with Total Recall. Same thing with RoboCop for sure. And for Showgirls, you know, there's such, and you can throw Basic Instinct in here too. There's such salaciousness so out there that it's hard to see past it to any sort of other content. You know, it honestly took me until a recent watch of this before I even knew about your documentary to get this movie, to get Elizabeth Berkley's performance, that she's doing this almost definitely before I even knew anything about this, because Verhoeven is directing her to do this, is asking her to do this. And the fact that she did go over the top and that far into it is actually impressive. And it's a weird thing to say because there is objectively suspect acting in this movie, but it's also, I could see where it came from. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just something that Verhoeven has naturally in his movies, to where it invites more analysis the more times that you watch these things, even for his pulpy things like Basic Instinct and Showgirls and his more violent stuff like RoboCop and Flesh and Blood and all that stuff. It's just fascinating that somebody takes a deep dive like you did into this Showgirls, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, it was, you know, it's a bad movie from like the traditional sense of it, you know, and so I think when it was easy to, you know, it was an easy target for a lot of people. And it was obviously the things that stood out, you know, it's distracting, you know, the nudity, the vulgar language. I mean, everything, a lot of the choices made. And so I think that, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, those criticisms aren't valid, because, you know, I do think they are, but, you know, I think what ended up happening was, you know, it succeeded in a unique way because of those failures, you know, and that's what makes it special, and that's what makes it unique. And I really wanted to to connect it to the rest of his films, because I think that's what makes it so interesting, is that you have this director who had, you know, amazing success. I mean, he had just come off of, you know, three blockbusters in a row. I mean, the way, you know, they made movies and we consume movies were very different from now. And to have that, and then to come, you know, have Showgirls be, you know, your next project. And he kind of spent all of his kind of political Hollywood capital, you know, he got this blank check to make an NC-17 film because he was so successful with his other endeavors. And he expressed a lot of frustration with the process of cutting Basic Instinct down to an R rating and having to do that. And so I think he got MGM to sign off on an NC-17 film. And so he kind of had like a blank check, you know, you could say, and him and Joe Esterhaus kind of knew they could do whatever they wanted with this one. And, you know, that probably led to, you know, some decisions that were made that, you know, are very questionable, but
we're going to do this because we can do this.
I mean, that's what it feels like sometimes, you know, I know that, you know, I hate to question all of his intentions, but you know, that's the impression that it's hard to kind of look past. And I thought it was interesting to kind of connect it back to all of his other films, because in the process of doing this, when I first started, you know, after the screening at Cinespia with the, you know, when Elizabeth came out and introduced the film, I kind of started to go back and I was curious, and I started reading everything that had been written about Showgirls. I mean, it wasn't a lot. There was a couple books, you know, I found Adam Neyman's book. I found Jeffrey Conway's Book of Poems, which was, you know, kind of mind blowing. You know, I've been reading all the reviews, you know, discovering the musical. And, you know, I was just really fascinated by, you know, the various points of view about this kind of complicated artifact in our culture. And I thought, like, oh, okay, well, if I'm going to do anything with this, I should definitely watch all of Verhoeven's other films. Because I, you know, I'd only seen the American ones, and that was like mind blowing, because so many weird and strange things that, you know, we love about Showgirls and that confuse people about Showgirls and don't make, you know, a whole lot of sense in Showgirls, like, connect back to his earlier works, you know. And so I just wanted to find a way to kind of blend everything together and show that, you know, that Showgirls is, you know, uniquely Verhoeven. It's Verhoeven at his purest, you know, I like to say.
That's something that I was going to bring up, was this documentary does something pretty unique in that it shows how his prior work informs what you see in Showgirls. There's so many times it cuts back to an older movie where something exactly like what happened in Showgirls happened in that movie. And there's a moment where a critic is talking about how crazy this is. And I think it cuts back to Black Book and it's basically saying, why is it not salacious in this movie, but in this movie it's completely salacious? And why are we having an opinion of a different opinion of how Showgirls does it compared to what this movie does with it, which has been considered high art and everything? Is that what you were going for there?
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to, you know, I wanted to kind of create another subplot where the Verhoeven characters in his other films were kind of interacting with my contributors and the experiences, their experiences, and connecting them to Showgirls. And so I wanted to find those moments in his other films where, you know, it the outrageous things, the salacious things, and kind of connect them back to the things that we see in Showgirls that, you know, people, you know, kind of screamed at, you know, with their fiery torches. So.
Yeah. They're pretty fun little sequences in here where you'll have people sitting down in the RoboCop lab and Showgirls is on. And,
yeah. And, or the fourth man with it in the background.
Right. And you have in Basic Instinct, you have Michael Douglas going to his computer and looking up Elizabeth Berkeley and finding 790 matches and all that. I really do enjoy the, I did enjoy those little touches that you put in this.
That was, yeah, those were kind of some of the fun ways to kind of have everything kind of interacting with each other. And, yeah, thankfully that was something I was able to do. And yeah, because that was, you know, kind of what people were really drawn to in some of the early cuts, like the candy, I would say, where, you know, the visual references where, you know, you could point to something specific on the scene or, you know, connect, you know, a little montage of, you know, other moments in Verhoeven's films where, you know, a similar moment or a similar motif or, would happen. So, you know, I kind of had to, you know, evenly sprinkle those out, you know, throughout the film. So,
you mentioned the different cuts and everything. It seems like you did a little bit of everything in this film, specifically things like the editing. Is this kind of a thing that you enjoy, or is this more of a chore for you, the editing process? Because there's a lot of footage. There was a lot of assets that you had to combine in a certain way to make the narrative make sense and to make it a coherent story from top to bottom. Is that something that you dig on, or is that just something like you're like, all right, let's dive in and see what happens?
Yeah, a little bit of both. I mean, I'm an editor by trade, so my day job is a television editor. So I, you know, had been making movies ever since I was a kid, but, you know, in the last 10 years or so, just mainly focused on editing. And that's where I kind of thought I would end up. And that's what I wanted to do. And that's the part that I really enjoyed the most. And so it was, for something like this, it was something that was very natural. And I felt like I had to kind of figure it out myself. And I mean, I don't know, I definitely would have been able to afford myself or an editor like myself for the amount of time that, you know, I put into it. So it was, in the beginning, it was a fun, I mean, this is my first feature. And I thought this would be a good project and a good kind of personal project that I could work on in the background and not really have, not set myself up for any expectations. So I kept it pretty low profile on it, pretty quiet. I didn't really tell most of my friends.
Oh, wow.
I would just kind of work on it on evenings and in between diaper changes and on weekends and stuff, and just try to find, carve out time for it. And yeah, so I definitely enjoyed the editing process of it, but it was definitely one of the things that was the most challenging at times, because, you know, in the beginning, it was just trying to figure out, like, how is this thing gonna play out? I started by kind of editing each kind of theme or thread or scene, you know, as its own piece, you know, so I would have these, you know, maybe 15 or so moments or vignettes, that I started working with. And then after those were done, then I would kind of start moving them around, and that's when kind of like the structure kind of started to take shape. So it was kind of figuring it out as I went along.
Nice.
Did you try to get interviews with cast and crew?
No, I didn't set out to make a behind the scenes or making of, and I did in the beginning. I wasn't sure if that was a route I was going to go down or was going to try to go down. But after reading everything and after kind of consuming, you know, all the kind of Showgirls afterlife, you know, the consuming all of that writing and that art and speaking to those, you know, those artists, I knew that that's where, you know, where the story lived, because ultimately I kind of saw the cast and crew's job as done, you know, and with something like Showgirls, it's kind of more about how it lives with us today than, you know, kind of their own personal take or their own personal experience. I mean, it was important for me to kind of hear from them through interviews that they've done over the years, just to kind of hear how things have shifted a little bit. And it was interesting to hear how they spoke about it at the time of its release, you know, before all the reviews. But yeah, I kind of saw this from the beginning as, you know, how this movie has lived and it's evolved. And, you know, I always kind of go back to my contributor, Haley Melodic. You know, she said, you know, the reason we're still talking about Showgirls is because we're not done with it. And I think that, you know, I don't think we're done with it even after this movie. You know, I don't think
renewed interest.
We're gonna figure it out anytime soon. And, you know, 10 years ago, I couldn't have made this movie. And I think 10 years from now in the future, I think, you know, it would be a completely different, you know, conversation we'll be having about it. So it's unique in that aspect.
I was kind of glad that it wasn't cutting back to people like, you know, in a studio somewhere with a plain background talking about the movie and everything. You just kind of let the voiceover do the work.
Right.
Yeah, because so much of what it is, you know, just seeing Showgirls on the screen and then, you know, seeing his other films. I mean, they're so rich and beautiful. And I just did. And knowing what was done with Room 237 and Los Angeles Plays itself and films like that, I was really inspired. And it was a nice problem to have, you know, just to know, like, I can't cut back to anything else. So it really made... you just have to kind of reframe your thought process visually about how to kind of tackle each thing. And, you know, you just kind of look beyond, like, okay, well, I don't have anything to cover this spot. I'll just cut back to the person talking. But I didn't have that. I didn't have that to fall back on. So
There's another interesting omission to me in this. I'm not saying your documentary is incomplete. I'm just saying it's interesting when you start talking about a lot of the movies that this compares with, like Mommy Dearest and Valley of the Dolls. And you mentioned Plan 9 from Outer Space and these type of movies, the Room doesn't show up and Birdemic doesn't show up. Was that a conscious decision?
The Room came up and I'm trying to remember who came up with. One of our contributors kind of mentioned The Room. And that was in, I had, you know, that in a couple early drafts where we talked about The Room. But ultimately, I think that it's hard to kind of compare Showgirls with something like The Room because they kind of were created from two completely different systems. A small independent, you know, production like The Room, which is, you know, amazing and you know, a wild ride, but, you know, it didn't come from a studio system. And so I think that you know, it's hard to kind of compare the two. And The Room has had, you know, a very similar afterlife or what, you know, what is looking like that, you know, people celebrate it, you know, midnight screenings and stuff. And you have just this really, really, really loyal, hardcore fan base, people who just love it. But with Showgirls, I really wanted to kind of also connect it to, kind of the queer experience. And I thought that, you know, Mommy Dearest and Valley of the Dolls, you know, with the Jeffrey Conway, my poet, who wrote the book of poems about Showgirls, you know, kind of calls it the trilogy of camp. And I really, you know, kind of wanted to focus on that side of it. And so, because it's become such a part of, you know, our culture and our lexicon, you know, over the last few years.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Well, and it's also, you know, Verhoeven has this style, and I think this may be his showiest, no pun intended, showiest piece in terms of the scope, the cinematography, what he's shooting. Las Vegas is so glamorous on its own, but as you say in the documentary, the different vignettes between the different shows, I mean, he films these as shows, so you can see the production values, even in the auditions and even in the rehearsals where, you know, Patrick Bristow is telling her to thrust it and thrust it and all that stuff. Like, there's just there's a lushness to it, even with all that camp thrown in, that that I think makes it stand out even from those trilogy of camp movies that you mentioned, that makes it, like you said, wholly unique. Because he certainly went for it. Like you said, if we can do it, we are going to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's a talented and established filmmaker. So he knows what he's doing. And then that was one of the interesting, things when I talked to, Barbara Schulgasser Parker. She was one of the only critics that I was able to kind of, convinced to do this, because I wanted to find a critic who didn't review it positively back in the day and would still kind of come on and talk about it negatively now, or, you know, wanted to be a part of it. And she recognized the brilliance in her early reviews, you know, of his, you know, from The Fourth Man and all of his early, you know, European films, and saying, like, so we know he's smart. We know he knows, you know, how to make a good film, but this is just garbage. And, but even, you know, even she, you know, to this day, she was like, I watched it again and it is very watchable. It's very watchable. And I think that's why, you know, that was just such an interesting perspective. You know, she knew it wasn't something that you could just dismiss as you know, kind of trash. She's like, I understand what makes it so watchable, and I get that, but, you know, I find it deeply problematic.
Yeah, if this movie is on in the background, you don't know anything about it. This is not just something that you ignore in the background. There's no way to do it. If the nudity doesn't get you, then all of the like just out of character reactions to things, especially from Nomi herself in this. I mean, you know, a lot is made of her just pulls a knife on the dude in the car and like, you know, throws a bunch of fries all over the place, saying different places. You know, which, by the way, I thought that was a nice touch. Your LLC is different places. But yeah, you can't, I think that's the thing that people are kind of getting at with us, right? Like, it's not your average bad movie. It's
no, I love watching it with people who haven't seen it before. Over this past summer, I was with my husband's family. You know, we go up to their family's lake in Indiana every 4th of July. And, you know, everyone was really excited about the documentary, and, you know, they were like, oh, should we watch it? I was like, well, no, we should watch Showgirls, because you'll see the documentary at some point, and I'd rather kind of take them through Showgirls. And so we, you know, I hosted a screen for them, a couple cousins and his parents and, you know, my sisters-in-laws. And it was just so funny. Just being with a group of people like that who had never seen the movie, and everyone was like, what? My mother-in-law was like sitting on the couch kind of away from the TV, because it was this small TV like in the corner of the bar that we were watching it at, and she couldn't hear all the lines, and she would be like, what did she just say? And I'd be like, I don't want to repeat these lines to her.
Yeah.
I can't imagine watching with my parents.
No, there's no way I could watch this with my parents. That, I mean, I'm glad also, I mean, not that it's very possible to ignore, but that Robert Davi line, that as he's walking off the stage and says, must be weird to be in a job that where people don't come on you, is one of the craziest things I've ever heard in a movie.
I know, with the movie, yeah, with the music underneath it, and sentimental, you know, kind of like almost like fatherly, you know, it's just like mom and dad are here, just got to see my big show, and, you know, gonna kind of send me off back to, you know, the dorms.
Mentioned in this documentary, though, and this is what I like about this, is the while there is some great appreciation for this movie, you also do bring up some of the social problems that this movie has. One of them is that black characters in this movie are meant to service the main character and deify them, essentially. And the other one is the sexual violence problem, a scene that comes out of nowhere in the movie. And even when there's a so-called redemption, it's not even a redemption by the character that the sexual violence happened to. What do you say about Verhoeven's his body of work? And is this something that is just a flat out mistake, or is it just something that's par for the course for him?
Well, I think, I thought it was interesting to kind of go back and look at Showgirls through that lens, but I don't think, when it comes to race, the racial issues that kind of pop up in it, I don't think that Showgirls or Verhoeven is somehow, unique in that sense. I think if you go back and look at a lot of the movies and television that were, that came out in that time or earlier, we could probably, we'd be shocked to see the images and how they're portrayed. And so I think that, we can only kind of learn and take those mistakes and kind of go forward with them. But when it comes to the sexual violence aspect of it, the thing that stood out for me was just the repetition and the how much it popped up in all of his films. And so was really shocking. And I didn't want to make any kind of direct accusations or how it's used. It's very easy to see when you watch it, you can see how problematic it is. And so I wanted to point it out, and I wanted to then use it as a way to kind of talk about Showgirls specifically. And I thought that it was the thing that people like to point to. And at least, even myself, it's you look at that revenge scene at the end, and when you watch it with an audience, people are cheering and they're howling, it's such this great empowering moment. And I really appreciated the commentary about that, saying Haley's commentary, saying this is held up to be this justice, and this only shows that women don't have any justice if putting out violence and delivering pain is the only way that, Nomi and can get justice for her friend Molly, then that's, that's a failure. And so, so I really, really kind of appreciated that take on it, cause then that you can take that and apply it to, similar scenes in other films,
sure.
And just look how, violence is being used. So,
yeah, there's something really odd about that scene to me. The sequence of events is that Molly goes in and the singer is like, I'm going to have my two bodyguards in on this. But when Nomi does the big fantasy retribution scene, those two bodyguards are just kept outside, and they don't get on this because it's a fantasy. It's a revenge fantasy. If they were allowed in on this scene, then it wouldn't happen nearly like this. It's just a weird sequence, overall. Yeah. One thing that it leads to, though, you also, one of the things about this documentary that's also unique is how, sort of a new industry has popped up out of it. You have this one show that sprung up, it's a Showgirls musical. And you have another one. Is it just a drag show that, you have, this Peaches Christ, which I love that name. I love that stage name. You have the Peaches Christ, it was, his real name's Joshua Grinnell.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's it.
Just Christ. he does that show, and then you have Showgirls the Musical, which has April Kidwell, who's sort of a doppelganger for Elizabeth Berkley. What was it like exploring that area of Showgirls?
Yeah, I mean, that is kind of where Showgirls has lives, you know, is within those communities and those performances. So, you know, Joshua, you know, who's Peaches Christ, is, you know, an iconic San Francisco drag queen. And she started hosting midnight film screenings back in 1996. And the first film they did, I think it was, she said it was Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. And then the second one was Showgirls. And
oh, wow.
And so what she does was she would introduce the film, but then host, you know, do kind of some sort of recreation in the movie, a scene from the movie with, you know, with other San Francisco drag queens. And then they would play the movie afterwards. So it wouldn't be like a full recreation, but it would just kind of prime the audience for the experience. And so I think it was just a fun way for them to kind of celebrate the films that they love, the characters they love, and find ways, you know, fun ways to kind of perform and experience those with audiences. And so that had been kind of a really long running series. I think she actually ended Showgirls about 5 years ago, just because that was the one movie that they would do every year, you know, in addition to, you know, other camp and cult favorites, you know, like Drop Dead Gorgeous, you know, Sister Act.
Oh yeah.
Nice.
You know, just, I mean, you name it, you know, you name it, and they've probably screened it and, you know, recreated it on the stage. But yeah, I know that she ended it about 5 years ago, just because, you know, like, give it a break for a little bit. And then the musical was going on in New York. It was an off-Broadway musical by Bob and Tavly McSpith, who had made lots of musicals about, you know, kind of like pop cultural shows, you know, kind of taking a show or a movie and kind of making an original musical about it. That they started with, I don't know if it was their first one, but they, before they did Showgirls, they did Saved by the Bell, the musical. And that's where they...
Oh, is that where that footage came from?
Yeah, that's where they met April Kidwell as, you know, Elizabeth Berkley. And our played Jesse Spano. And then after, you know, doing that, they were like, well, we met April. Now we have to do something else with her. Why don't we just do Showgirls? So that was, you know, they basically just made Showgirls because, you know, they wanted to do another musical with her. And so she, and then, you know, more recently, they did a West Coast production of that with Peaches Christ. So April Kidwell and Peaches Christ did the San Francisco run of Showgirls musical more recently. And then she took that and turned it into her own one woman show and was touring that around the time that we, our festival run called I Know Me, where she took Showgirls, her character, Nomi Malone from Showgirls, and blended it with I, Tanya, and basically did, it's brilliant. It's, you know, just a wild, wild performance. Where she plays, you know, what's supposed to be Nomi Malone's mom, but it's like Tanya Harding's mom, you know, in the movie Tanya Harding. And so it's this strange kind of prequel, sequel of her journey. So, yeah, it's just interesting how it inspires all these kind of little creations and probably will continue.
Well, and Peaches even says, she says that she wanted that show to be as dirty as possible, and like, with, you have people coming out and doing lap dances with people who got large popcorns.
And they started to do was anybody who bought a large popcorn would get a free lap dance, and they basically would recruit, you know, these disgusting San Francisco drag queens to then, you know, go around the crowd and start giving the audience lap dances before the film. And so, you know, people would hold up their large popcorns in the air and take them there. Hey, right over there. And, you know, I mean, it was funny because, you know, I had the interviews with Peaches where, you know, she would describe these screenings, and, you know, I saw photos, but they weren't really, I mean, they were cool, but I then went to San Francisco and worked with her, her manager, you know, her production manager, and he kind of dug out this box in the back of his storage, you know, his closet, where it had like old VHS tapes. And so it was there where, you know, I got some of the old footage of these screenings and performances. And that was just like, oh, just, you know, made everything come together.
I've discussed this with people before about what makes camp, and you and your movie sort of discusses this throughout. It's trying to come up with an answer. The answers that are presented in the movie are the ones that I think where camp comes from. And it has to be where you and everybody that you work with think that you are making a serious movie and do not recognize how bad it is.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. It takes a lot of basically bad stuff, but plus just no awareness.
The easy thing, because it's hard, really, it's camp is kind of a hard thing to kind of define, because it seems like every person kind of has their own definition of what camp is. I don't know if you guys remember, was it last year with the Met Gala, the big costume ball out in New York, their theme was camp, and you know, these celebrities would come with these costumes, you know, gowns and everything. And then there was this debate online about, oh, is this camp? Is this not camp? You know, on for a gala that was, the theme was camp, and people were debating whether this was a success or a failure. And I think, you know, it's one of those things that's really hard to define. But what I kind of kept going back to was kind of the classic Susan Sontag wrote an essay years ago. It was called The Notes on Camp. And that was kind of what people kind of use to refer back to, you know, how to define what camp is. And the easiest way to kind of summarize it is just failed seriousness, you know? And I think that, mm-hmm. you know, once you're able to identify that and see that, then I think you might be in the presence of camp.
Yeah. That's one of the big interesting things to me about this is watching what Verhoeven and Esterhaus thought of this movie when it came out as compared to what they feel about it now. 'Cause it feels almost like they've bought in now. They've become converts. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really interesting aspect of this documentary.
Yeah, in his more recent interviews, you know, he kind of started to, I felt like, kind of dip back into a little bit of the, you know, some of the early, the way he talked about it, you know, on its original release. And so I think it's interesting just to hear the way that they talk about it and how they kind of defend it and where their thoughts are with it. And I love that little moment in the documentary where he's asked about it in 2016, and he's, you know, kind of comparing it to German paintings of the 20s and 30s, and you know, people just didn't get it at the time. It's, everything is exaggerated and over the top, and so he's saying like, yes, that was intended that way. I intended it to be over the top, but I was trying to, you know, mimic these, you know, expressionistic paintings, and then, you know, he's like, so maybe people didn't get it at the time. And then, you know, he's at a film festival, or, you know, there's an audience there, and you can just hear there's silence, you know. And then he says to the moderator, he's like, well, what, you don't believe me? He's like, well, I invented it yesterday.
Yeah.
And even with, like, in our screenings, it's like you get like a little bit of a chuckle, you know, or there is silence, you know, after those statements, and then, you know, everybody laughs. So, I mean, there shows some awareness. I mean, he gets that, like, you know, oh, people might not believe me anyway. Well, whatever I say, I can say whatever.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's pretty similar to what I've seen from people like Tommy Wiseau, who have basically, it's so ingrained into the marketing for what that movie is now. It, it makes it, you know, he's free to now say, well, I meant to do make this as a comedy all along, and I'm glad everybody's enjoying it as it is, and it's not a piece of forgotten, you know, film lore. It's not something that just came out and left. Now people are really enjoying it, so I'm just going to be on board with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's what, when, you know, Paul Verhoeven accepted his Razzie, that was the thing he said. It's like, well, I'd rather people be talking about it than for it to, you know, die on some video shelf. So
right. Yeah.
He knew that, you know, that he was the first director to do that in person. And, you know, so that shows also like a level of like an awareness and commitment. And he knew like, okay, well, I'm going to want my work celebrated regardless of the way it's being celebrated, you know, whether that, regardless of how it's celebrated. So I think he appreciates, you know, the afterlife of, you know, the film.
Yeah. I don't think we've spoiled your documentary too much. I hope we haven't.
No,
I think that there is a lot still unexplored, and I think we can just, I'm gonna let Barrett's got more questions, obviously. I'm not ending it or anything. I'm just saying that there are a lot of things about this that will make you appreciate this movie more, so I don't want to make people think that we've gone through the entire documentary here.
Oh, for sure, and we can wrap it up soon, but I do want to get your thoughts on how you think Elizabeth Berkley has viewed this in contrast to Verhoeven and Astor House and everybody. It seems like from the footage that you were showing, either right after the movie came out, 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road, and then at the Hollywood Forever screening, it seems like she's been a staunch defender. Like she's held to her guns. Like, this is the right part for me at the time. This was a challenging role to me at the time. It had to do with dancing, which I had a lot of familiarity with. It broke me out of the Saved by the Bell character. And she seems genuinely appreciative of this movie, according to the footage that I see in this documentary. Do you think that she has changed her opinion over time? Do you think that she views it as a camp classic? Do you think she's as wishy-washy as Verhoeven? Or do you think that she stands by this just as it is?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I think that she, I mean, if you follow her on Twitter or Instagram, you know, she's always, you know, if there's a Versace reference, you know, she will throw that up there. So I think she was early to understand that, you know, the film had this following, and she appreciated that following. And I think she was happy that it did find its audience. And, you know, she has an experience and a relationship with the film that is, you know, kind of truly unique, and, you know, I'm sure caused her much pain at the time, but, you know, but her performance is what people love about it. It's what people return sure. to. It's what people celebrate. You know, it would not, you, the film would not be the same without her. So, you know, it, you know, back in the day when people, you know, might've said like it was miscast or, you know, she was terrible. It's like, well, okay. Like I understand your point. Yes. You know, you could have cast somebody else, but would we still be talking about it now? If, you know, if Charlize Theron was in it, like she was rumored to be, or, you know, so I think it's just one of those kind of magical, everything kind of aligned, you know, in this strange way to create this really interesting film that's just become kind of an interesting part of our culture, you know, and it's still controversial. It's still, you know, up for debate. I'm excited to see what people think of the documentary, and people to discover Showgirls for the first time, you know, younger generations, and, you know, just to see what they think of the film, and just, you know, because the conversation is going to keep going. You know, it's not the type of movie where, you know, everyone's going to just kind of clap their hands and be like, okay, we figured this out.
Done with that.
You know, yeah.
I honestly do not think there's no way this movie would be talked about if Charlize Theron was in it. Like, like the idea that somebody from Saved by the Bell, this just sweet, innocent, pure Saturday morning soap opera comedy thing, got an alum from that to be in this movie. And the fact that I love the comparisons too, between this and Jesse Spano, by the way, I love all of that stuff that you throw in here. I mean, if you put Charlize Theron in this movie, I don't think she would have trusted Verhoeven if he said, go all out. I don't think, I love her as an actress, but I do not think that she would have gone all out on this.
Commitment and the physicality. I mean, it's just, she throws everything into it. I mean, I read somewhere, it was like Drew Barrymore maybe was also rumored, and then like Madonna, I think, was for the crystal part. And it's just like you it's interesting to see these like, oh, what ifs, scenarios. But it's like no, we have the jewel in front of us. I'm so glad that it turned out the way it did.
This is coming out, this beautiful movie, this documentary, You Don't Know Me, N-O-M-I as in Know Me Malone, is coming out on digital and VOD on June 9th, correct?
Yes, correct.
And it is absolutely delightful. Chris and I have watched it and we loved it. I am a big supporter of this movie, the Showgirls, for a while now. And so this hit me right in the feels. And I enjoyed every minute of it. And I really appreciate you not only making it, but also coming on to talk to us for a long time about your experience with it to give us more of a context.
Thank you. Yeah, I really appreciate the conversation. You guys were awesome.
We'd like to thank Jeffrey McHale for coming on to the Sincast. If you've got any comments, do we put these on Facebook, Barrett? I don't think we've ever had one.
No, we won't. Yeah, we'll put them on all the regular.
Okay. So, yeah, Sincast presented by CinemaSins on Facebook. Comment on this. You can also go to CinemaSins Twitter, Music Video Sins Twitter, and we have a SoundCloud and Discord. But once again, we'd like to thank Jeffrey McHale, the director of You Don't Know Me, coming out on June 9th. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. Yeah.
All right. Well, that'll do it for this interview. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.